was clearly topped, however, by my very favorite story of all time. In the dead of winter, with the temperature well below freezing, a mom called me at work and asked, "Can my child get rabies if a skunk peed in his eye?" Apologizing for my laughter, I reassured her that he couldn't, but I had visions of a pet skunk, which was common in Oklahoma, crawling over her son's face at play and somehow causing this accident. So I asked her, "How could that have happened?" She replied that when he had gone out to empty the garbage, when he lifted the lid of the can, the skunk got him. I said, "Oh, you mean he was sprayed by the skunk. He must smell terrible. What did you do for that?" She said, "Oh, it weren't that bad. We let him back in the house yesterday." I asked when this had happened, and she said, 4 days ago." I guess that's the only tale I ever experienced that needs absolutely no embellishing. Besides some great stories, we did get two great things while in Oklahoma. Mary Lynn was born in May of 1964, and Lisa was conceived before we left there. The other positive from my Army service was the association with a fellow physician who was carried away with coin collecting. My dad had inherited a very diverse and interesting box of rare coins, which were somehow amassed by his dad in the backwoods of North Carolina in the late 1800s and early 1900s. As a youngster, my dad had tried to interest me in coin collecting, but it didn't grab me then, but boy, it surely did in the Army. I had Dad send me the family coins, started reading, trading, buying, and found myself absorbed in my third great near-total obsession. It became a major influence in my life because the hobby gradually grew into an investment avenue for college costs and retirement, and in the late 1970s, I formed a corporation for purchasing rare coins for investors that netted me some wonderful travels and a rather substantial nest egg. By the time the kids needed the funds for college, the coin market had softened, so I financed their college, held the coins, and they gradually provided the funds for my banjo collection, which I'll mention later. In the summer of 1964, the middle of my two-year Army stint, we visited North Carolina to look for a practice to join. I was offered a position in Chapel Hill with Drs. Senior and Schaefer, which was tempting due to our fondness for Chapel Hill, but we opted for a more ordinary hometown USA environment, which seemed like a good choice a few years later, with the drugs and beatniks so prominent on college campuses. We decided to join a three-man group in High Point, which proved to be a superb place to live and raise a family. Arriving late June 1965, we rented a small house at the corner of Gatewood and Council, two blocks from my office, for $135 a month, and were able to make it for a year or so with only one car. My salary the first year of practice was $10,000. Lisa was born about 2 months later. As we house hunted, we quickly became fascinated by Wellington Street, a dead-end street five blocks from the office, within easy walking distance to schools from five-year-old kindergarten through high school, and bordered by the golf course of Emerywood Country Club, which we expected to eventually join. Few houses on the street were adequate for our size family, but about 15 months after moving to High Point, one became available, and I ignored my prior intention of not buying a house until I had saved a down payment of at least a third of the cost of the house. Built in 1941, it proved to be a marvelous place to live and for our children to grow up. We paid $26,500 for the house in rough condition and immediately spent $3,500 and many hours fixing it up. We assumed a 6% note that had 17 years remaining on it and had house payments, including taxes and insurance, of $215 a month. In 1972, we added a breakfast room with a sizable pantry and a large den, and sided the house with a combination of aluminum siding and cedar shingles, putting approximately another $12,000 into the house. In retrospect, knowing how much houses appreciated in value through the 1960s and 70s, we probably should have upgraded. But every time we looked at houses costing more than we could get for ours, we came home and decided we loved the location and house and wouldn't have traded even Stephen. Medically, High Point was both good and not so good, depending upon when you ask. The group I joined was clearly the dominant pediatric practice in town and did good medical work. However, all three men were substantially older, and two of them seemed, from my perspective, resistant to progress. 19 and a half years later, the practice consisted of the same four of us, and I was very frustrated by the lack of input I had. This frustration, however, was also substantially contributed to by two other major factors. First, actual pediatric practice was a major disappointment to me. Rushing through large numbers of patients, most of whom were trivially sick, was not very fulfilling, and I was somewhat shocked to discover that the majority of parents did not really want quality, in-depth pediatric care that I had been trained to give. Most parents were operating under what I call the McDonald's mentality, a term I coined for quick fix care. Secondly, at this stage of my life, although we usually attended church, I had not established any real relationship with God through Jesus. This, of course, led me to have and to create major problems both at work and at home. More about that later, but to stick to the current topic of medical practice, I often gave serious consideration to leaving pediatrics for some other specialty, but inertia always won out. Dealing with kids was never the problem. They are marvelous. In the mid-1980s, we finally began taking in some new associates in anticipation of the eventual retirement of our senior associate, who by this time was in his mid-80s. In 1985, the three of them had cumulatively practiced 114 years, and within a seven-month period, all three retired from the practice, and I was slated overnight to go from the youngest to the senior partner with two younger associates. Unfortunately, due to some unethical actions on their parts, instead, I rather suddenly became the only doctor with a four-man practice. I had to streamline the office staff. Nancy came to work to handle the computer billings, and I hired a physician's assistant since no pediatricians were available on such short notice. Despite having substantial debts and obligations to the retiring men and working harder than I ever want to again, it was a growing experience, and I learned a lot about myself. Interviews with many young graduating pediatricians failed to turn up one who was willing to work half as hard as I was. So in almost 3 years of solo practice, I wore out three physician's assistants, paid off all the obligations, and banked a considerable amount of money. Some of that allowed us to purchase our 95-acre farm in Southwest Virginia in November of 1986, and I reckon that that tranquil hideaway probably kept me sane. By the end of this period, however, there was not much left of me when God sent Dr. Ravenel to join our practice. About 2 or 3 years younger than me, he had practiced earlier, then been in academic pediatrics in Greensboro for about 11 years, and for various reasons now wanted to re-enter practice. A mature Christian, he and I were not only able to work together happily on a handshake, but able to work out some novel, unequal ways to split the load and the income that resuscitated me. Typical of God's perfect timing and planning, I doubt there was any other person God could have sent whose qualities and needs would have matched mine so well and have made possible such unique working arrangements to help us both. Having experienced the opposite really makes one appreciate working with someone whose word is his bond. And as Joseph said about his brothers in Genesis chapter 50, verse 20, I can say, what they meant to cause me harm, God has caused to bless me. For about the past 15 years, I have had an increasing interest in children struggling in school due to conditions such as attention deficit disorder and learning disabilities. And as a result of my unique working relationship with Dr. Ravenel and Dr. Ellis, whom God sent to us in 1992, I have been able to devote nearly full time to these medical problems and make a major, in-depth contribution to the children and the community while not having to continue to work nights, weekends, and holidays. Having done that for 3 decades, it was surely wonderful to stop in 1990. Interestingly, my last holiday to work was Labor Day of 1990. Now let me shift back to spiritual matters and tell about the most important and influential event of my entire life. By the late 1960s, the frustrations of life in general and my spiritual state of bankruptcy led me to ponder some really drastic options. But at the same time, I was noticing several people around me that had something I did not understand, knew I wanted, but had no concept how to even start looking for it. On February the 3rd, 1970, at work, I was suddenly taken sick. Assuming it to be the start of influenza, I secluded myself in my office, checked the time of day, and said or thought to myself, I never got sick this fast, and I don't know if I can even work until noon. A voice that was not audible, but carried total authority, spoke to me very clearly and said, you're not sick, you're afraid. Realizing that all those symptoms I was experiencing and attributing to the flu, weakness, shakiness, sweatiness, were indeed also the symptoms of fear, without hesitation, I spoke out loud to this voice and said, afraid of what? Without any condemnation, the voice answered, everything you have always wanted to have and everything you've ever wanted to be is slipping between your fingers and you are powerless to stop it. Knowing that to be a perfect description of my life, I said, God, I don't even know if you exist. And if you do, I don't know why you would listen to someone like me. But if you exist, and if you are listening, I can't do it myself. I have to have help. I spoke in desperation, expecting nothing. But the instant I spoke those words, all of my symptoms disappeared, and I felt a giant weight lifted off of me. And I actually sat up straight and said, wow. I went home at noon to learn that at precisely the same minute, Nancy had a similar experience while she was visiting at a home Bible study in town. Not knowing the Bible, I did not know what had happened to me and thought surely a preacher could tell me. I sought out a guy my own age who seemed to be sort of a regular Joe, but unfortunately he didn't have a clue, and he needed the experience as badly as I had. In short order, by sharing the experience with some of those friends in whom I had seen such a peace, I learned that I had been born again, saved by grace through faith. I wish I could say I have walked constantly under the perfect influence of Jesus since that time. I have not, but His influence accounts for every good thought and every good action since, and He has brought an abiding peace in times of major stress. Major beneficiaries were our family and all 3 of our children, who within a few years matured to the age they could each accept Jesus as their personal Savior. As a family, we had lots of great times camping, traveling, kayaking, and playing tennis, all of which, except the tennis, are chronicled in our family vacation log. In 1971, we purchased our fourth child, Luke, a boxer puppy born next door, who quickly took over the family and provided us tons of fun and love. Nancy and I decided it was okay to spoil one of four children, especially since he wouldn't grow up and raise a family. He blessed us all until he died in early 1984. From 1980 to 1983, our nest gradually emptied, which was both sad and good, and we adjusted. In 1984, my dad and mom relocated from Edenton to High Point and enjoyed 5 good years before Dad's health started failing in 1989 and he died in 1991 in March. Mom has continued living in their condominium since and has done remarkably well. Watching our 3 children mature and find their places in the world as constructive, useful citizens and adjusting our relationships with each of them as adults has been an unspeakable joy. Mary Lynn married in 1988, and Mark and Lisa tied the knots in 1990. We have been blessed by the fine choices all 3 of them made, and extremely blessed by the grandchildren, who at this time are coming fast and furious. Considering that natural births have advantages over doctors' doings, but considering Nancy's in my freedom to travel now, I have decided that all children should be born vaginally, but that all grandchildren should be born by cesarean section so their births could be scheduled. Just joking, of course. My fourth great consuming hobby has been banjos. I guess I was always attracted to its happy sound, and know my interest got stimulated by the TV program Hootenanny. Playing the piano, I assumed I could learn to play one, and in my time and training in Rochester, I started looking, but never found one there. In Denver, I visited the Ode factory and paid a month's salary for a banjo and a Pete Seeger instruction book from which I learned to play. By the late 1970s, rare coin prices got so absurdly high that I decided to collect a few banjos. There were no decent reference books then, so I lacked any kind of direction until 1984 when I visited the Ring the Banjar exhibit at MIT and met Jim Bowman, the owner of half the banjos on display, saw his collection, and was instantly hooked on those Boston-made works of art from the 1880 to 1910 period. After a few years, I gradually expanded into banjo-related items with a major emphasis on statues and early photographs. The collecting disease is an incurable but fairly benign one, adding real spice to one's life. I sincerely hope I have passed it down to some of my children or grandchildren. Well, as this narration winds down, what are the really major changes I've lived through from 1935 on? Without spending much time pondering this, and not really wanting this to get too serious or profound, I guess I would say the 5 biggest changes I've observed in life in America might have been in roughly this order. Number 1, a decline in morality. Number 2, television. Number 3, working mothers with small children. Number 4, computers. Number 5, air conditioning. Concerning a decline in morality, this one is obvious and not really debatable. Respect for Judeo-Christian values has plummeted, and our nation is now reaping the just deserts. We kill millions of innocent and defenseless babies and try to hide the shame by referring to this as pro-choice. Children are having children. Families disintegrate. Many parents do not bother to discipline their children. Homosexuality is defended as normal, which anyone visiting or living on a farm knows is wrong. Even young children know it's wrong. We see polls that say large numbers of our citizens do not think morality should be a prerequisite for election to public office. Imagine someone actually believing that a dishonest man can be elected to public office and, once given power, represent other people honestly. I wish I could somehow make it the 1950s. If we don't quickly have a spiritual revival or find a treatment for AIDS, it may single-handedly bankrupt this country. Number two, television. TV is a mixed bag. It can vividly educate us about so many things and places and bring us news quickly and let us enjoy a giant variety of sporting events live. On the other hand, many people are consumed by it. Consumers are on the verge of having 500 channels from which to choose. How absurd. Television is in large part responsible for creating such absurdities as a 20 or 22-year-old athlete pulled out of college to be given instantly and unconditionally sums of money like $30, $50, $80 million. Sports have been transformed from something to do into something to watch others do. Many of our kids are fat and lazy. Many of the athletes our children watch have become strutting, bragging, trash-talking, self-centered babies in adult bodies. The sports world is a mere shell of what it was when I was growing up. Number three, working mothers with young children. Can it be done right and the children not suffer? Of course it can. But for every successful example, I submit that there are many, many failures with the children paying the price. I hear the heartbreaking term latchkey children and think back to occasional school day afternoons I was off duty and at home when our children got out of school and barely got a foot inside the door before they hollered, "Mama," and rushed to Nancy to share the details of their day and get a hug and a kiss and, when needed, some encouragement and consolation. Any woman who elects to have children should be absolutely certain that her work does not interfere with their emotional and spiritual needs. Computers. Obviously, I should choose my words carefully with two of my children owning a computer company. We have just really started to feel the impact of computers. They obviously make many good things possible, and many things possible much faster. They also have the potential to allow some people to control other people, to cripple our society when they are down, and they contribute to instant gratification tendencies. Considering the current insistence of getting everything instantly, it will soon be either expected or required to get news before it happens. It will be fun to see how mankind tries to arrange that. Time will tell whether computers are ultimately a positive or a negative. Air conditioning. I really don't want to sound too negative, so I'm glad I finally got to a change about which I feel overwhelmingly positive. Boy, I'm glad I was a youngster in the days before air conditioning. I can hardly see how we functioned without it in this section of the country. One marginal comment. Even though it happened in my lifetime, this next gimmick did not make my list of the five biggest changes I've witnessed, but I do want to tell you what I think ranks as possibly the all-time most effective invention for the least amount of money. The lowly concrete speed bump. I think the inventor should have received a large cash award and then been banished to some distant planet. They are effective, but boy, they're aggravating. Well, if I started by saying I was talking most directly to my grandchildren, having lived through about the last two-thirds of this century, do I have any advice for them and for anyone else who cares to eavesdrop? I surely do, and I'll keep it brief and to the point. Number one, save sex until you're married and every non-medical drug until you're buried. Number two, accept Jesus as your personal Savior as early in life as you can comprehend and understand what He did for you, and then walk with Him steadfastly. Number three, read, regularly eat, and memorize the Word of God. It will protect you. Number four, work hard to get a really good education. Number five, do not marry anyone who is not a born-again Christian. Number six, develop your sense of humor and work hard to keep it healthy. Number seven, practice and practice some more until you are really comfortable being able to say, I love you, I'm sorry, and I don't know when those are indicated. God bless you and thanks for listening.